We're driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. Leveraging over 140 million qualifications and preferences every day, Indeed's matching engine is constantly learning from your preferences. So the more you use Indeed, the better it gets. Join more than 3.5 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/Blue Wire. Just go to Indeed.com/Blue Wire right now and support our show by saying that you heard about Indeed on this podcast. That's Indeed.com/Blue Wire. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
You don't want it. You don't need it. But you're going to get it anyway. The Kevin Sheehan Show. Here's Kevin.
Denver does have a timeout, but they're not using it. 4 seconds. Murray, step back. Three-pointer. Long go. Fight for the rebound. Martin. And it's over. The Miami Heat have tied the NBA Finals.
Mike Breen on ABC last night with the final call. Jamal Murray's three-point attempt to try to force overtime just missed. And Miami has squared the NBA Finals at a game apiece. Great basketball game last night. Much more coming up on that in a few minutes. One guest on the show today, Nikki Javala from the Washington Post, will be on with me. We will talk Washington football. Tomorrow is day one of mandatory minicamp, 3 days of minicamp. Today was what they call an in-house media day. You may have seen some of the social media. Chase Young is there. Curtis Samuels wearing jersey number 4 this year without Taylor Heinicke on the team. You may see later on today, or maybe even you've seen it as you're listening to this podcast, a couple of interviews with some of the players, with Julie Donaldson or London Fletcher, the in-network, the team in-network broadcast group. And I think maybe one of those interviews will be with Chase Young. But he is there. So was Leno Jr. So was Montez Sweat. Minicamp tomorrow, and that'll be it. Once we get through minicamp this week, it's waiting for training camp to get underway, end of July, first part of August, so the players will have some time off. But Nikki Javala coming up on the show, a show today that is brought to you by Window Nation. You can beat the heat and the humidity with Window Nation's summer sale. Save thousands today with no money down, no payments, and no interest for 2 full years. Plus, Window Nation will give you 2 free windows with every 2 you buy. No limit. Protect and increase the value of your home today. Call them at 866-90-NATION. Go online at windownation.com. Mention my name. You'll get a free estimate. So there's really nothing to lose. But no interest for 2 years and half price on the windows because you're getting 2 free with every 2 you buy. 866-90-NATION or online at windownation.com. I did not hear, by the way, the sonic boom yesterday afternoon here in the D.C. area. For those of you who know what I'm talking about, it was around 3 o'clock-ish in the afternoon, and there was a loud boom that was heard basically throughout the Washington area. I don't even know what I was doing at that time. I think I was watching golf. I was watching golf because I was watching Denny McCarthy try to win the Memorial. More on that coming up. But apparently there was a plane that was flying into restricted airspace, and they turned the F-16s on this plane that was flying in D.C. restricted airspace. And as they were chasing down the plane, one of these F-16s hit the speed of sound, Mach 2. And that created The Boom. I wish I had heard it, but I did not. I was completely oblivious to it. Now, unfortunately, that plane, they could not get the attention of the pilot. That flight flew into Southern Virginia and crashed, killing four on board. That's what we know about it as of now. There was definitely some information that wasn't totally clear yesterday afternoon into even last evening, but it does appear as if the sonic boom that was heard was an F-16 chasing down a Cessna that was in restricted airspace, and that Cessna with four on board crashed, killing all four. Reminds me, sadly, of that Payne Stewart flight, remember, because you would have to assume that, you know, for whatever reason, something had incapacitated the pilot and perhaps the other three passengers on board. And it may have been the loss of oxygen because that that plane was flying, I think, at 32,000 feet, something like that. But sad that it happened. But anyway, let's start with game two of the NBA Finals. What a game that was last night. And I'm so glad Miami won the game. Most of you know at this point, I just want to keep watching basketball. And so midway through the second quarter last night, when Denver had turned an 11-point deficit into a 15-point lead, a 26-point turnaround, it was at that moment I said, this is going to be a very short series. Miami just hit them with a couple of haymakers to open up game two, and Denver didn't blink, and they're up 15, and Miami can't guard them. You know, and I thought this is just going to be one of those things where the better team is much better, and I was dead wrong on this being a 7-game series. But I shouldn't have, because Miami's been down double digits in so many games in this postseason on the road, and they've come back, and they came back, and they won the game. And now I have hope for, you know, what I had predicted, which was a long 7-game series. I'm still not sure about that. It's not like I said it super confidently. I said 6 or 7, but my actual prediction was Denver in 7. But, man, Miami was impressive last night. They were impressive from the bench to start with. Eric Spoelstra is really, really good. And on Friday, we had Chris Miles from NBA TV on the show, and we were talking about sort of what the strategies were. And I think I had talked a little bit about sort of the ideas that I had for Miami prior to having Chris on. And Chris did expect Miami to really come out and give its best effort, even though he liked Denver to win the game last night. I did not bet the game. The line went off at 9 again. I didn't touch it. Miami won the game. And to me, they won the game first and foremost because of their defense. More than anything else, Miami won last night because of the defense they played against Denver. I know they shot 17 of 35 from behind the arc, and that was a big reason why they won the game. All right, they weren't going to win the game without shooting 17 of 35 from behind the arc. But it was their defense that was impressive to me all night long. And Eric Spoelstra made the adjustment. He made several adjustments, but the one big adjustment, at least lineup-wise, that he made is he inserted Kevin Love into the starting lineup, allowing Love to guard Aaron Gordon and Jimmy Butler to guard Jamal Murray. And when we talked on Friday, I said, you know, to me, it's Miami guarding Denver that, you know, it's got to change. I mean, Gordon had attacked a much smaller cover in game one early. They struggled all night to cover Denver in game one. Even though Denver didn't shoot it great from behind the arc, it was, you know, it was bigger and stronger and better. Jamal Murray got off. And I said on Friday, Jamal Murray's the one that you got to focus on. And I even threw out, you know, I'd even consider, I know it's kind of high school, college-ish, but I'd even consider some sort of box and one on Murray with Butler guarding him, and just don't double Jokic and let's see what happens. And you know what? They played so many defenses last night, but it started with Love in the starting lineup, Butler guarding Jamal Murray, and Butler was outstanding on Jamal Murray. Butler has definitely taken a major step backwards in terms of his aggressiveness as a scorer. I would even suggest he hasn't played well offensively, and the shooting percentages would suggest that. But last night, his defense on Murray was outstanding. Jamal Murray ended up with 18 points on just 15 shot attempts, second lowest output for him during the postseason. And really, the lower output was in a blowout win. He had 26 in game one on 11 of 22 from the floor. And if that game had been more competitive in the fourth quarter, it's possible he would have, scored another 6 to 8 points. He averaged 32.5 in the Western Conference Finals. You could have made the case for him as the MVP of the Western Conference Finals. And I just thought that's the guy that you really have to stop from getting off. Like, if he continues to get 26 to 30-something a night and Jokic is getting double-digits assists and also getting 28, impossible. It's going to be really hard anyway. And Spoelstra, they ran, that the new lineup. They covered Murray with their best defender, Jimmy Butler. And Butler's so strong. He's also longer than you think. And he really disrupted Murray. And it wasn't just Jimmy Butler defensively. They were all great. Bam's been phenomenal in these first two games. He's been their most valuable player. It's amazing what an offensive facilitator Bam is. I mean, they've got him out in transition, making decisions early in a possession, and he's making all the right decisions so far in the first two games. But they all really guarded last night, and they did a great job guarding. Kyle Lowry, for 37, 38 years old and his size, man, does he battle defensively. So I thought it was their defense overall. And then, of course, 17 to 35 doesn't hurt. It was a big part of it. And then I think there was this stretch in the basketball game. There were two of them in particular. When they got down by 15, I really thought, this is over. And over the next 7 minutes, including the last, five or so of the first half, first 2 to 2.5 of the second half, they turned a 15-point deficit into a tie ball game. And this has been part of the Heat's MO during the postseason. They just don't go away. It doesn't matter how many points you have them down by. And, given the, altitude and Denver's home record, and I didn't think this was going to be the night, but they worked their way back into that game, and that was a massive stretch. End of first half, early third quarter. They not only hung in there, they came back and tied the game. But then Denver got some distance and led by 8 at the end of the third quarter. And then the second most important part of that game was the beginning of the fourth quarter. And Miami, Duncan Robinson in particular, scored 10 points in like 3 minutes. I mean, Duncan Robinson, by the way, has been really, really good as a shooter, of course, but I think he's been excellent, off the drive in his decision-making and his playmaking. And he just, that stretch of basketball at the beginning of the fourth quarter, when they went from down 8 to up 12. I mean, that wasn't the beginning of the quarter, but eventually they led by 12. There was a 20-point turnaround in the fourth quarter. But those first 4 minutes of the fourth quarter, when they went from down 83 to 75 to up like 92 to 87, that was massive. And then Butler came in, and Butler kind of closed it out in kind of Jimmy Butler fashion. Knocked down a huge three, got an and one three-point play, hit a tough 18-foot pull-up jump shot when all of a sudden Denver had hit back-to-back threes. Gordon made a three. Jamal Murray made a three. And Denver kept coming. They had an opportunity. And then the very end of the game sequence was interesting. Denver's got the ball. They're up by 3, 111 to 108. And with about 12 seconds to go, Jimmy Butler takes a step back three. I actually thought it was going in, and I thought it was a good look for them. And Denver, with two timeouts, rebounded the ball about 11 and a half seconds roughly left. They could have called timeout. They could have advanced the ball into the front court. They would have had a chance to extend the game, perhaps, you know, go for a quick two to get it down to a point and then foul. They would have had another timeout to move the ball. If the, you know, both free throws were made, they would have still had a chance to shoot a three at the end to tie it. But they didn't. They decided to go without a timeout, and Murray got a look. But he got a look after Butler had knocked the ball out of his hands back towards half court. He went to retrieve it and then, you know, had to hit a contested step back. Look, he's made that shot a lot. I don't know why Malone didn't use a timeout there. I don't know. It's a small nit to pick because Murray had a pretty good look. And that's, you know, if you are telling, you know, Denver, you're going to get Jamal Murray on a step back three. It's going to be contested, you know, by Butler, but he's going to get, you know, some space to shoot it. You know, you take that. But I think you could have extended the game there by using your final two timeouts. He didn't. Malone, by the way, talked about effort after the game. I mean, part of his whole diatribe after the game was that he didn't think his guys gave enough effort. Man, that's tough to question a team that's been on this kind of a roll, that hasn't lost at home in the postseason, to question their effort. He knows his team. Now, he's right defensively. They were not dialed in defensively, and they haven't been at times during this postseason. They're not, you know, they're not the most consistent of defensive teams, but man, did they lose shooters. You know, and the other night in game one, and we talked about this on Friday, you know, Miami had the open looks. They just didn't knock them down. And if they had, you know, it would have been a more competitive finish in game one. Well, they knocked him down, and they let Strus get off early. Gabe Vincent was phenomenal. I thought Kyle Lowry played really well again. And here we are, a game apiece. Now it's Denver's turn going to Miami on Wednesday night. What do they do? Well, I mean, they've got to figure out a way to get Jamal Murray going again, no matter what Miami plays defensively. I think they can use Murray actually on the post. I mean, Butler's a tough because he's so strong, but Murray's pretty good scoring from just about anywhere. But they were blitzing those pick and rolls, and he just had a tough night. And I also think clearly Denver's got to improve defensively because these teams typically shoot much better from home than they even do on the road. And so you can't leave off of pick and rolls and even the screens off ball. You can't leave shooters wide open. They ran a curl with Duncan Robinson last night, and I understand the attention Duncan Robinson should get off of, you know, off of a down screen. But both defenders went with Robinson, and they left Gabe Vincent wide open for a corner three. And there was just a lot of miscommunication defensively from the Nuggets. But two, you know, well-coached teams, so much so with Miami. It's really, Spoelstra has etched in stone his Hall of Fame status as a coach. And last night was a beauty for him and for that team. I mean, they're just tough. And remember, you know, about Miami, the one thing we've realized during this postseason, they have shooters. You know, they got a bunch of guys that can really shoot it, you know, from Strus to Vincent to Duncan Robinson, obviously. Lowry's had some moments. Kevin Love can extend it. Jimmy can shoot the three. It is, you know, the kid Highsmith that's come in, he can shoot it. They've got a lot of shooters. So Denver, it's Miami came out and they were the urgent team. They were the physical team. Denver's going to have to get that way defensively, and they're capable of that for sure. But we're 1-1 going back to Miami. I don't know what to expect the rest of the way. I'm just going to sit back and enjoy it. I mean, I think it's nuts to bet against the Heat anymore, and I didn't. I had them in game one. They didn't cover. I didn't play the game last night. They're 2.5-point dogs at home in game three. I still think Denver is going to prove to be the better team, and they're going to win their first ever NBA championship. But man, this Miami team is fun to watch for so many different reasons. Fun to watch for most of the day yesterday was Muirfield Village, the Memorial Jacks course in Columbus or Dublin, Ohio. And the reason for some of us, especially locally, that it was so much fun to watch was that Denny McCarthy, Georgetown prep zone, UVA zone, I know a lot of people in Denny's family, coached one of his youngest cousins in basketball. Denny was a very good basketball player at Georgetown Prep. In fact, last week they had a PGA three-point shooting contest with tour players at Ohio State, and Denny won it easily. He can really shoot it. We've had Denny on the podcast and on the radio show several times over the last few years, and I think he mentioned to me once that Gary Woodland's a really good basketball player. I think he said Dustin's a good player. There were a couple of others. But Denny's a good all-around athlete. You know, he's a good athlete. He was in contention to win for the first time on tour. He's been close a couple of times, but not like yesterday. And not, you know, at a venue or at a tournament like yesterday. That is, you know, one of the bigger PGA Tour events. And it's played on a brutally tough golf course. And Denny had a two-shot lead on the back nine and then had a one-shot lead coming to 18 over Victor Hovland. Hovland made an unbelievable long putt at 17, and that ended up being the difference ultimately. Denny's one of the best putters on tour, and some of the putts he holed out on the back nine at 14, 15, 16, 17 were just so impressive. But the driver got a little bit loose on 18, and he needed par on 18 to win. And he pulled the drive left, had to lay up, and then had a putt to win it and just barely missed it from 23 feet. Then had, by the way, a tough five-footer coming back to force the playoff and drilled that. And then going back to play 18 in the playoff against Victor Hovland, his driver got a little loose and went far right and was in the rough. And he hit, I thought, was a really good shot that just barely missed climbing up onto the green. And if you know anything about that golf course, 18 is straight up the hill is the green. I've actually played that course. And thank you, Jeff Bankston. And it's a spectacular track, but there are steep, you know, parts of the course. In fact, a lot of the tee boxes are straight uphill. Like you have to walk straight up a hill to get to the tee boxes. But the 18th green, his shot just barely missed staying on the green, and then it came back and it rolled all the way to the bottom of the hill. He hit a good shot up and had a chance on a par putt to force a second playoff hole, but missed it. But look, it was. I sat there and just watched him in this tournament all day long. When he took that lead, you know, after going out in three under and had it to eight under par, and really the other guys were backing up. I mean, Rory, I mean, God bless Rory McIlroy. My God, the putting. It's just a disaster at times. Guy hits it better than anybody on tour, but just can't get up and down and just can't putt sometimes. I mean, for Rory, when he's got one of those 3 to 4 footers for par and it's a big one, it just seems over the years now, it's like even money he's going to miss it. And so he faded away, and Siwoo Kim faded away. And Scheffler was in at 6 under, but I didn't think when Denny had it at 8, the way he was playing, I didn't really think he was going to move back to 6. So it really took Hovland's putt at 17 and Denny's, you know, loose drive on 18 and then again in the playoff to cost him his first chance at a win. Hovland wins in the playoff, but he is a really tough competitor. He's a grinder, like all of those words apply to Denny McCarthy, and he plays the tough courses and the super fast greens, which you will see at LA Country Club coming up in 2 weeks for the U.S. Open. He's going to win on tour, and he's going to be a threat at some of these really tough venues, like U.S. Open venues. Like, it would not surprise me that, you know, if in the next couple years, Denny is not only, he's played well in majors, but it wouldn't surprise me at all if he becomes a major winner in the next few years. And starting in 2 weeks at LA Country Club, where he actually talked about it and said that he had played a few times, I'm looking forward to that. Great effort. So many people in this area proud of him. And the effort just would have been nice to see him get it done. I know nobody's more pissed about losing it than he is. But at the same time, he played great. And, one of those learning experiences. Look, Hovland's going to win big, too. I mean, Hovland's going to win majors. I mean, what a ball striker he is. All right, that's a lot of golf for this show. A lot of golf for this show. Two more things before we get to Nikki. Number one is that Buffalo added Leonard Floyd, the pass rusher. So they've now got Floyd and Von Miller. They signed Ed Oliver to a long contract extension the other day. But Floyd was one of those pass rushers that are out there. I've mentioned Ngakoue is out there. I think Washington is unsure of what they have off the edge. I love Sweat, don't get me wrong, and I don't want to make a huge deal out of this. Chase Young is still, the hope. I don't know if it's the expectation anymore, but it's the hope. And, for all of us that were big fans of his coming out of Ohio State and even after his rookie year, I hope he figures it out. I hope it works out for him. I think it's up to him. But Buffalo, they had Von Miller. They had Ed Oliver. They had the kid from Miami that they drafted in the first round, Rousseau, from a few years ago. And they understand that they're going for something here. And they added Leonard Floyd to the mix. I know Washington drafted two defensive ends at the end of the draft. I know they've got Chase Young, next year. I know Montez Sweat had a good season last year. Actually, had an excellent season overall. But, 8 sacks. I just think that there should be maybe some consideration if a guy like Ngakoue doesn't get signed to a real deal and there's an opportunity to add a guy that's got 19 and a half sacks the last 2 years for something, resembling an incentive-laden deal or mostly an incentive-laden deal. It'd be interesting, although I don't think that's what you can get Ngakoue for. I think it'll cost more. But anyway, the Bills signed Leonard Floyd. I wanted to mention that. I also wanted to mention, and I don't think I mentioned this on Thursday, did you guys see the stories that were out there about Jalen Hurts and the Eagles? Two stories in particular. One was written by Greg Bishop at Sports Illustrated that said that last offseason, Philadelphia wanted to trade for Russell Wilson, but Philadelphia and Washington were the two teams that Russell Wilson nixed with his no-trade clause. I think it was Washington, Philadelphia, New Orleans, maybe Carolina, and then Denver. Those were the teams involved. But there was a report that the Eagles were ready to trade for Russell Wilson. Keep in mind, I understand where we were a year ago. The biggest mystery involving the Philadelphia Eagles was Jalen Hurts and whether or not he was the right guy. But, Howie Roseman maybe got lucky on that one. Maybe just a little bit lucky on that one. The other thing is, another report came out that in 2020, in the draft in which they took Jalen Hurts, they actually preferred Jeremy Chinn, the safety that's in Charlotte playing for the Panthers. But there were injuries and some questions, and so they went with Hurts. But that really their preference was Jeremy Chinn. And just two interesting stories, and I just bring them up because Howie Roseman's getting, bouquets of flowers thrown at him. As if he's the greatest general manager in the history of the game. He's good, don't get me wrong. I'm not, suggesting that Howie Roseman hasn't done a great job in Philadelphia. But man, there is some luck involved in all of this, in football in particular. I mean, because what if Russell Wilson had gone to Philadelphia last year, started and had the year that he had in Denver? What if they had drafted Jeremy Chinn and they were stuck with Carson Wentz for a little bit longer? Anyway, all right, let's get to Nikki Javala, talk some Washington football team and more. We'll do that right after these words from a few of our sponsors.
Philip has just lost the respect of the youth league football team he coaches. He was asked what New England should do in the draft, and his answer was objectively terrible. The Athletic just wrote a great article about this. But Philip doesn't have the Athletic or the respect of a boisterous group of 11-year-olds who once looked up to him. Learn from Philip's error, get the Athletic, and get the info you need to speak draft fluently.
All right, jumping on with us right now is Nikki Javala from the Washington Post, has been covering this team for a few years. You can follow Nikki, as I do, on Twitter, at Nikki Javala, J-H-A-B-V-A-L-A. You know, there are things to get into here as we are on the eve of the mandatory minicamp. But before that, I wanted to ask you, so what is this? Is this year four for you covering this team?
Yeah. 2021, 2022. Yeah.
Year four. All right. So, yeah. Compared to other teams that you covered the Broncos for, a few years, and I don't know, other teams that you've covered, but is this an easy beat? Is it a difficult beat, or is it somewhere in between?
I wouldn't say it's difficult. I think it's all consuming. The Broncos were, they were pretty competitive, too. I mean, it's a competitive market, and there was a lot going on with that team, too, with on-field stuff, ownership stuff. The Commanders are next level just with everything going on off the field. So it's all-consuming. I don't know that it's more or less difficult. I would say maybe a little bit more if you're used to primarily sports and you're now thrust into multiple federal investigations.
Right.
But yeah, there's a lot more going on, for sure.
Have you enjoyed it?
I have. I mean, I love my job. So it's, you know, I don't have a life otherwise. So I don't mind working 24/7. And I like, this is going to sound so cheesy and cliche, but I like learning new things. So while I don't love the topics I'm covering all the time, I always find it fascinating when I'm learning new things or I'm challenged in some way, you know, sort of with those investigations and forced to kind of go outside my little football bubble a bit. So yeah, I really do enjoy it.
You know, having, as one of the few born and raised Washingtonians and having lived through all of the years in which this, you know, this city became, well, it fell in love with its football team. The football team was so important to this city. It was the biggest unifier in the city. But you're right. Like, you know, doing what I do, doing what you do, I mean, they're different. But at the same time, you know, a lot of what drives what you, you know, write about and what I talk about isn't, you know, what we necessarily expected. I've gotten to the point where, honestly, I'm sick of it. Like, and it's been even longer because it was happening long before you got here. Now, it's certainly accelerated with all of the investigations and, you know, all of the stories that came out of your newspaper in July of 2020 and thereafter. But I've gotten to the point where it would just be nice to have kind of a normal functioning football franchise and be able to talk about that primarily. Do you feel the same way?
Yes. I mean, that would be amazing. I think the last time I covered a somewhat normal functioning franchise, I mean, the Broncos were pretty well run. There were ownership issues, but like to cover a winning team with a franchise quarterback was 2015 when they won the Super Bowl. So it's kind of gone downhill from there for me. But yes, I think it would absolutely be nice. I mean, my parents were long-time Washington fans. They met in D.C. They grew up in D.C. They ended up moving to North Carolina and became really mad when they no longer aired Washington games. And the Panthers were kind of the main thing out there. But, you know, I remember my dad driving up just to, you know, 6 hours just to watch a game at RFK and absolutely loving it. He had, like, that fake hog's nose. And, I mean, he was really into it. And I would absolutely love to see that spirit, that energy here again.
Well, so you're telling me something, and maybe a lot of my listeners something that we didn't know about you. Did you grow up a Washington fan?
By association, a little bit. I was so young at the time. I mean, there are old pictures of me and my brother wearing, like, Riggins jerseys. But my dad was a, I mean, they were diehard fans. And it just kind of faded because of the distance, and they didn't air as many games locally in North Carolina. So by association, yes. I mean, our bigger sports in my family, we're big-time basketball family. My brother played college basketball, and my dad is from the Bronx originally, so we're big-time Yankees fans. So it became more basketball and baseball, the football side. I didn't really have, like, a huge team growing up. But, yeah, my parents were, back in the day, big-time Washington fans.
Where did your brother play college basketball?
Brown.
He played at Brown. Now, were you an athlete? Mm-hmm.
No, I was the least athletic in the family. Apparently, my parents gave all those genes to my siblings.
So
writing is the closest I could come. My sister ran track at Penn. I went to state school to write about sports. So thanks a lot, Mom and Dad.
Wait, so you had your sister went to Yale, your brother went to Brown, and where did you go? Did you go to NC State, did you say?
Sister went to Penn.
Penn.
I went to North Carolina, Chapel Hill.
Oh, you went to Chapel Hill. So were you guys big Carolina basketball fans when you said, you know, you grew up on Tobacco Road. I mean, you were, so I'm assuming that, you know, you were either North Carolina Duke or NC State or Wake Forest fans.
Yeah, my dad went to NC State, undergrad and grad school. So we started as NC State fans. He's still loyal to NC State. I have no regard for NC State at all. I find it, no, please, no. I'm all UNC or anything anti-Duke. That's kind of my
Well, that's what you and I thing. Then have in favor, in common, I mean, because as a Maryland person, that's, you know, we both hate Duke. Did you ever go to Reynolds Coliseum to see a game with your dad?
I did many times. In fact, I have, like, old pictures of him with Tim Valvano. I actually watched a lot of women's basketball games there. I saw Team USA when Dawn Staley was actually playing. I was a huge fan of.
Well, Kay Yao was the coach there for years, right?
Yeah.
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 Her sister was the AD at Maryland for many years, Debbie Yao.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Is your favorite sport? College basketball?
I'd say it's more NBA. Having lived in New York for, I don't know, like 6 years after college. I mean, basketball was always our family sport. So I just kind of always followed it. I was the NBA editor at SI for about 5 years. So I've always really loved that level the most. I admit I haven't been following it nearly as much lately just because I'm immersed in Commanders and NFL stuff, but I still love it.
Did you cover the Nuggets when you were living in Denver and covering the Broncos? Did you do anything with the Nuggets?
I did not. No, I was all Broncos all the time. When I was in New York, that was during the time of LeBron's decision. That was interesting. There was a lockout then. I didn't cover the Nuggets.
What kind of sports town is Denver? I think that's one of the cities that not everybody on the East Coast is familiar with in terms of, I know that the Rocky Mountain region, everybody like Cooley, you know, who I did a show with for years and is a good friend of mine. I mean, he grew up in Wyoming and grew up a huge Denver Broncos fan, but what is like the market, the Denver market like as a sports market?
It's a great sports town. It really is. I mean, because you got every pro sports team there, like all the leagues there. It is still primarily Broncos, even now. I think a lot of fans have really gained an interest into the Nuggets as they've gotten good. But the Broncos have always kind of dominated, for better or worse. The Rockies have a following, but it's more the casual fan who likes to go for the experience of games because you watch too much of them. I mean, they're just maddening, given their ownership. And the Avs, there's a pretty solid following. But yeah, it's a great sports town. And Boulder's not too far, Colorado State. I loved it there. I think people think it's more of like a smaller market, but it's not. I mean, on the media side, it's incredibly competitive, and it has such a rich sports media history. I don't know that many people have really thought about it, but you think about some of the great writers and reporters. I mean, Schefter was in Denver for the longest time. A lot of great media people to come out of Denver. So I loved my time there. I still love it there. My parents are all out there. My whole family's out there. So, yeah, it was a good experience.
Rank the teams in order of importance. It's Broncos 1, right?
Yeah. In terms of importance to the fans, yes. Broncos, and then depending on, you know, I'd say it's probably right now, number 2 is Nuggets, and then Avs and Rockies, but, you know, there are years where still baseball dominates. I think local media, I know my editor, you know, is a big baseball guy, so they would, you know, probably give the Rockies a little bit more covers than they deserved at times.
All right, well, let's talk about the team for a little bit. Although that stuff was interesting, and by the way, you know, like, I wonder for people like you and all of those people on the beat that end up interacting probably more with other beat reporters in other markets than maybe we do with like radio talk show hosts in other markets. I mean, I know a lot of guys in other markets, but you're typically at events and you run into these people all the time. What do other people in, you know, your specific business covering teams, what do they say to you about, you know, the job you have covering this team?
It's a lot of, I don't know how you do it. I don't know why you do it. You know, it's sort of, I hate to say it, but I mean, this team has kind of been like the punching bag of the NFL for the longest time. They're just kind of the joke, and nobody, they see all the headlines. They're like, I don't want anything to do with that. It's just too much. I see the journalistic value. I love it. I kind of, in some ways, I hate to say this, you know, I hope they do become normal and a successful winning franchise, but it's also like, oh my God, what am I going to do with myself when that happens, when they normalize? Like, yeah. I don't, like, how do you, you mean there's going to be a Wednesday when there's not, like, massive breaking news? What am I going to do? So, yeah, there's a lot of that. I find it amusing, like, Green Bay right now, you know, I think there was a lot of, like, you know, massive reaction to Aaron Rodgers, which, you know, is warranted, but it's also, like, from a media standpoint, it's like, oh, my God, how am I going to do this? This is going to consume my whole summer. I'm like, if the biggest news here was just that the star quarterback was leaving, like, I mean, that'd be amazing. Franchise-altering news is like a daily occurrence here versus, you know, a once every 5-10 years thing at other franchises.
So what do you think the reaction will be when it's finally over and Josh Harris and company take control of the team? I mean, we've all had these conversations about, will everybody come back? Will, you know, Josh Harris's prospectus to his co-investors essentially said the number one reason for buying this team is once we acquire it and Snyder's gone, we'll see an immediate, you know, exponential increase in revenue because people will come back. What do you think happens when, you know, everything is finalized?
Yeah, I mean, I think there could be, you know, a spike in interest initially, but I think it'll ultimately come down to whether they win or not. You know, eventually the intrigue over the sale, over Dan Snyder leaving, is going to wear off. You know, this sale is kind of the new shiny toy, but, you know, if they don't win, then it's going to be the same old. And they got a lot of work to do to get them there. I think they have a really good roster. But obviously some missing pieces compared to other successful franchises. You know, that's it's kind of an uphill battle with their stadium right now. I mean, I don't think I'm, you know, reporting anything groundbreaking here and saying that FedEx is kind of a dump. So, you know, getting fans back is one thing. Sustaining them is another. And I think that'll be the biggest challenge this new ownership group faces.
Nikki and Mark Maskey wrote over the weekend that Josh Harris is scheduled to meet with the NFL Finance Committee on Wednesday of this week. We know it's kind of a two-step process. Finance committee approval, they pass it on to the 32 owners, and then they vote to ratify. So will they get finance committee approval on Wednesday?
Well, so the way it works is the finance committee doesn't necessarily approve or disprove it. They give a recommendation. Usually it's a unanimous recommendation or a, you know, maybe we shouldn't vote on this. And they pass it along to full membership. So will that happen Wednesday? Probably not. I still think they need to do some vetting. I know there's been a lot made of the LPs and the number of the LPs, and a lot of that is, you know, how many LPs does Josh in their group believe they have versus
right.
the NFL? Like, is Josh counting an entire family as one LP? The NFL probably would not view it the same way. So they got to kind of work through those things, and they got to vet all these people. And there's a lot of them, and some of them are international folks, and you got to really be thorough. So I could see them having, you know, maybe a couple more, you know, maybe meetings that are remote, and then they pass it along. You know, when this could be ratified, I mean, we'll see. I'm always hesitant to put a timetable on it because I feel like, as we've seen throughout this process, a lot can change instantly. Could it be late June? That feels super optimistic to me. I could see it maybe more mid-July, late July, early August. I hope no later than that, but we'll see.
Yeah, and I talked about this on the radio show this morning and on the podcast on Friday, and I understand that the normal process is this process, and it's not, Nikki, you know, a total outlier in terms of the amount of time that it's taking. That this, you know, last year it was Denver, you know, approved, and then they finally got to voting on it in August. But the sale is different than any other sale they've had. You know, it's an owner that they desperately wanted out, by the way, by voluntary choice to sell the team, which, you know, wasn't ever a guarantee. It's a $6 billion sale in which there was one person, just one, willing to step up and meet the price. I guess I've just gotten to the point where I'm a little bit frustrated because it just feels to me like the owners don't want to be inconvenienced. You know, it's June, it's July, and if we get around to voting on it, we won't vote by Zoom, we won't vote by conference call, we kind of all have to be there. Like, this, I think, could get wrapped up sooner if, you know, like if somebody said to them, look, you better get it wrapped up in the next 3 weeks or 2 weeks, or you might lose Josh Harris, they would get it wrapped up. Like, I think it's doable, but it doesn't seem like it's convenient for them to do it right now. Am I right or wrong?
I think scheduling probably plays a part. I think also it's a much more complicated deal. I know nobody likes hearing that, but I mean, the Broncos deal, the Panthers deal, those were easy. I mean, you have a super liquid buyer. You know where that money's coming from. You know it's real. Like, it's, and that still took time. I think on this one, both sides have to make concessions. And I think they will, from what it sounds like. You know, the NFL is running out of the Teppers. And if Bezos doesn't buy Seattle, if that comes on the market, and the Waltons, where, you know, one person can kind of foot the bill for all of this, you're going to need multiple people. You may need to introduce different types of financing, like private equity, as other leagues have done.
Right.
And I think Josh's group, rightfully, knew they had leverage, used it, and are trying to push the envelope a bit. The NFL, is they're used to having all the power and kind of dictating everything on their terms. So I think they're going to have to kind of meet in the middle, you know, be it, does that mean giving them a debt waiver so they can take on, you know, additional financing, but still drawing the line at no private equity. We'll see kind of how it shakes out. But I think that's a big part of it, is this one is just more complicated. And each side is kind of, at first anyway, kind of dug in their heels of, you know, these are the policies, you can't do this. While the other side is like, we're not breaking the rules, this is just creative financing, you know. So it's different. But I think, you know, as more teams come on the market, this is going to be the new norm, you know? Not everybody can, there's only so many people who can just give you $6 billion all cash, you know?
Yeah, they're going to have to change their rules. And they can't do it now with this team because ultimately they'd have to reopen it up to the people that could have done it had it been less restrictive, like private equity, you know, foreign money, et cetera. You did have a quote, you and Mark had a quote in the story where somebody, you know, familiar with the inner workings did say that, you know, they think it's pretty much 90% there. I mean, like, I am long past the point of thinking that there's even a slight chance that this isn't going to happen. It's going to happen. Do you feel the same way?
Sure.
Okay.
Yeah, it's going to happen.
Yeah.
It's going to happen.
By the way, you had something else in the story, and I don't necessarily – actually, I do care. I think it'll be interesting how it plays out, but I don't think it's tied to the sale anymore because Snyder and Harris have already agreed. They have a signed, fully executed purchase agreement. But it sounds like Snyder is still dealing with the league on this Mary Jo White investigation.
Yes. I mean, the report hasn't been released. So, yes. I mean, the league's certainly not going to say. Anybody can speculate, but, you know, how much of it is tied to the actual sale? I mean, not directly, but is the league waiting for this to get resolved to release the report? Quite possibly. Nobody said that. You know, they probably won't say that. But that still is a big piece. Now, does it have direct ties to the sale? I mean, only if Dan is still requesting indemnification. When we talk about indemnification, I think it's important to clarify that there are two sides to this. It's not just, you know, Josh Harris indemnifying Dan Snyder to a certain point. It's also about indemnification with Dan Snyder and the league, you know. And we were told initially that Dan Snyder asked the league and other owners to indemnify him, and they're like, heck no.
Right.
You need to indemnify us, in part because of these investigations that are coming down the pipe. And also, they never do that, and they won't do that. So, it's not, but it sounds like those two parts are close, if not already resolved, which is a huge piece, and it was there. So, I mean, that's kind of the tie-in with the other investigations. But I mean, that still is kind of hanging around. Same with the investigation led by the Eastern District of Virginia, U.S. Attorney's Office there. So, there are two things still floating around.
Yeah. We've learned a little bit about Nikki. We've learned a little bit more about the ownership and sale situation. Let's talk some football with Nikki, and we will do that right after these words from a few of our sponsors.
We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. Leveraging over 140 million qualifications and preferences every day, Indeed's matching engine is constantly learning from your preferences, so the more you use Indeed, the better it gets. Join more than 3.5 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/Blue Wire. Just go to Indeed.com/Blue Wire right now and support our show by saying that you heard about Indeed on this podcast. That's Indeed.com/Blue Wire. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th. Hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady. Live only on Netflix.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
All right, let's finish up with Nikki Javala from the Washington Post. We'll talk some football with Nikki. Before we get to that, this segment of the show is brought to you by MyBookie. Go to MyBookie.com or MyBookie.ag. Use my promo code, KevinDC. That's KevinDC to secure a first deposit bonus of up to $1,000. MyBookie's got everything you need for Game 3 of the NBA Finals. They've got all of your NFL Week 1 lines and all of your NFL prop bets for the upcoming 2023 season. Whether you're a diehard or a casual fan, simply put, there's never been a better time to start exploring the world of online sports betting with MyBookie. Use my promo code KevinDC. Bet anything, anytime, anywhere with my bookie. All right, so Chase Young, Nikki, what do Ron Rivera, Jack Del Rio, the coaches on the defensive side of the ball, what do they really think of Chase Young right now?
I think they think he's a tremendous talent. I think he still has a ways to go in proving himself, and that they would like to see him on the field. I mean, I don't think Ron or Jack or any of them really have tried to hide the fact that they wanted him here at OTAs. And yes, it's voluntary. It's up to the players. And I totally understand the ones that are trying to, you know, prevent as much as they can in football injuries when they're in contract years. I mean, I get it. You got to preserve your value. But this has been an every year thing with Chase. I think they want to see him step up as sort of a leader of the team, and really be there. So I think this is, I mean, you don't need me saying this, but it's undoubtedly an important year for him personally. You know, he's in the last year of his deal, but also him as being here, you know. If he has a monster year similar to the way Duran did last year, you can't let him go. You got to resign them, right?
Yeah.
And what that means for the rest of the line, we'll find out. But, you know, this could have huge implications, and it starts really today. I mean, he's there for media day, where they take, like, their big family photo, which will be the first family photo, I think, without a Snyder, right?
Well, it'll just be the football people, I guess, and Jason. Maybe I should have asked the question this way. Because I kind of sense that, almost like with Sam Howell, like there's hope. You know, they're wishing for the best case. But what are their actual, you know, expectations if there's any way that they could be objective about him?
Honestly, I don't know that they have expectations because they, and I hate to say this, I don't mean this to disparage Chase at all, but like they know they can win without him because they did win without him. And if I were Chase, I would view that as, oh, crap. Like, I need to make it so they can't do anything without me. They need me there, you know? But I think their feeling is, like, we can win with him. We can also win without him. So until he proves that, you know, he's indispensable, really, we're just going to move forward.
Is there any concern about his health anymore? Or is that, you know, is that a past thing? He seemed fully healthy when he came back and played in the three games at the end of last year. There's no concern about that, is there?
No. I mean, last I heard, he had multiple checkups with Dr. James Andrews, and he checked out just fine. So unless something changes between now and tomorrow when we get a chance to talk to him, I mean, everything I've heard has been positive.
All right. Other than the Snyder ownership situation, there's no bigger storyline as we, you know, head towards, you know, mandatory minicamp and then, you know, a month and a half or whatever away from – 2 months away from training camp, then Sam Howell. So what are your expectations of Sam Howell, and what do you think their expectations are?
I think expectations, I'd say they expect to see continued progress, which sounds like total coach speak, I realize. But I think they want to see and expect to see a young player who's going to make mistakes, but learn quickly from those mistakes. I think he should be a better fit for this offense with his mobility and just with the pieces around him. As far as, you know, my expectations for him, I mean, I think I'm going to hold out on giving my expectations until, like, because I feel like training camp is such a, it's such an overreaction time. You know, a lot of time they're going 7-on-7, they're throwing against air, they're not in pads the whole time. So you don't really get a good gauge of kind of where he is, you know, in his development. I think the two training camp practice at Baltimore will be huge for him and the offense. But if he can just kind of stabilize this offense, throw an interception in the end zone on one play and then have a monster play the next play, like, if there could just be, like, some stability, I think that'd be huge for him. And that sounds boring when I describe it, but if it wins games, I mean, great. That's what they need. They need to win.
Yeah, they do. I mean, Ron needs to win. We've talked about this a lot. I have with various people. I don't know if I've talked about this with you or not in previous interviews, but this year's a big year for Ron, but I kind of sense that it's a bigger year for Eric Bieniemy, because I view it, Nikki, as Eric's got a future. Like, he hasn't been a head coach before. Ron is kind of probably approaching the end of his career. He's closer to the end of his coaching career than the beginning of his head coaching career, obviously. How do you see it?
I agree 100%. Yeah, and I think they've kind of built the situation where it is, I hate to say tryout, because the man has achieved many things and he's earned much more in his career, but with the added responsibilities, the more, you know, the greater say over the schedule and the script and everything, I think they are very much kind of propping him up to be more akin to a head coach than, you know, an offensive coordinator. And obviously, he got the assistant head coaching title. But I think this is such a huge year. And yes, part of it is the ownership situation. There's no certainty for anybody, but especially him, for, you know, he's been trying to get a head coaching job for years now. This is the first time he has full control over his own offense. So I think it's going to be a huge time for him. And as you said, you know, he does have a future. Ron has, after this season, 1 year left on his deal. You know, whether he stays on as a coach beyond that, I feel like is up to him. But, you know, Bieniemy is kind of the next in line, it feels like.
All right, last one. Thank you, by the way, for giving me this time. You know, last year, and I mentioned, I don't know, Ben or John or somebody last week on the podcast, that last year at this time, they really felt like they had gotten it right with Jahan Dotson, even after OTA days in minicamp. Like, there was a buzz coming from that building that Jahan looked like the absolute real deal. And I think they were right about that. Is there anybody over the last week or 2 weeks that you're hearing that kind of buzz about?
Yeah, I think they feel the same way about Emmanuel Forbes.
Yeah.
But if they didn't feel the same way about their first-round pick, I'd have serious concerns. You know, this is the happiest time of year in the NFL. Everybody is a Super Bowl contender right now. Everybody has an all-star roster. Everybody has, you know, the utmost optimism and confidence in their group. And everybody looks great in camp, you know, when they're going, you know, 7-on-7 and throwing against air. And it's amazing. But, yeah, I think they do have a ton of confidence in Forbes, and he has looked good so far. But, like with everybody else, I think, you know, we'll really start to see what he can do when the pads come on and in preseason and once games get going. So, but it does, you know, they do really like the kid. But we'll see.
All right. Chapel Hill, Franklin Street, Nikki Javala from the Carolinas. I didn't know that. Had Riggins jerseys on, went to Reynolds Coliseum, saw Valvano's teams when you were a child. Keep up the good work. Always enjoy the conversation. I'll talk to you soon.
Of course. Thanks for having me.
All right. We are done for the day. Back tomorrow.